So to kick off today, it's my pleasure to introduce Andrew Jackson. Dr. Jackson is the Distinguished Professor and Provost Integrated Scholar, as well as the Chair of the Department of Civil, Environmental, and Construction Engineering at Texas Tech University. He's a board-certified environmental engineer, a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. His research interests include fate and transport, of a variety of contaminants in natural environments, methods to study these processes at appropriate scales, and biogeochemical controls on site remediation. His research spans the spectrum of pure science to the very applied, and his list of research and teaching accomplishments and publications goes on and on and on. But in the interest of time, I just want to welcome Andy and look forward to his thoughts on the relevancy of GSI to determining contamination extent and selecting remedies.
Great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to share my screen. Let's
see. Slides are up.
Can you see the full screen version?
Yes.
Great.
You're good to go.
So it's great to be here. This is a big topic. It's an important topic, and I certainly am not going to do it, justice. My hope is that I can share with you today some of the things that we've observed in our studies evaluating contaminant transport at these interfaces as more of a conversation starter than really a summary. But I hope that it's at least useful in what I can get across in 20 minutes. Let's see. So I'm going to go over a couple of scenarios that commonly occur for contaminated groundwater interfacing with surface water. Talk a little bit about why that interface is so important. Talk a little bit about what do we need to know about the interface. And then go through a couple of example studies that we've worked on for some contaminants migrating from groundwater to surface water. So this is one of the case studies I'm going to present later. I'm just using it kind of as an example. This is a groundwater plume of chlorinated solvents that's migrating offshore into a bay. So this is salt water. And one of the things I want to point out that I'll show in a cartoon next is that there's this fringe area, very shallow depth increase with distance, a marsh. And the tide range goes from essentially the edge of the marsh all the way through that grassland, but it actually penetrates all the way back to the forest. So during extremely high tides or storms when we have waves, you basically get overtopping, which can cause, very large amounts of mixing surface water with the interior groundwater due to density gradients. And so if we look at this from a little bit different perspective, you can see we can have bake drainage, so rapid drainage of groundwater to the surface water due to rapid fluctuations in the groundwater depth. That could be due to either freshwater inputs from precipitation or tidal impacts. And so that causes a lot of mixing between the low tide, high groundwater, low groundwater, storms, no storms, a very dynamic area of surface water, groundwater. Deeper down, we're going to have, more lateral transport and then generally upwards transport into the bay. But we're going to have relatively fresh water mixing with high salinity water, which is, again, another density gradient, another means of mixing. And of course, due to tidal changes, we can get tidal pumping. So the direction of water flow can actually reverse depending on the state of the tide and the state of groundwater. And so all of this means that when we have a plume that's migrating offshore, we have a very dynamic type situation, which can be difficult to study and difficult to understand what's occurring, particularly at the interface. And that interface is really important because a lot of things happen in it, which I'll talk about in a second. Freshwater, same kind of issue. So this is just another case study I'm going to talk about. There's a PFAS plume that's migrating. It's intercepting a pond It's surfacing into the pond, actually causing the whole pond to be contaminated with PFAS. And then on the other end, it basically dives back down. But I'm going to basically focus on the interface of the groundwater to surface water today. And again, this is a really complex situation. We still have variation in depth, although it's not as rapid. The tidal variations are, multiple feet per day. We can get certainly 2 to 4 feet in this lake of variation with depth, but that's not going to occur every day. It's going to occur over, days or weeks. But we still have this bank drainage issue. Also, in the near surface, we can often have low permeability zones, which I show with these kind of brown areas. Those low permeability zones are really important because, one, they can act as reservoirs of sorb contaminants. They can change the direction of flow. So as the water migrates up, it hits an impermeable level. It's going to basically be forced horizontally. They can also change the redox. And so all of that means that it's not as simple as just, putting a well, 5 foot well in and understanding that, oh, the concentration here is going to look like the concentration here. So let's talk a little bit more about the interface. And by the interface, it really depends on the exact situation. But generally, you're talking 10 centimeters to maybe a meter at most in terms of rapid changes. And there's really two scenarios that I mainly focus on. One is these highly soluble compounds that are transporting from an upgradient source and migrating to a surface water. That would be the plumes that I've shown you previously. And then we also have situations where relatively clean groundwater is migrating through a sediment in which there's a sorbed contaminant, and the groundwater is becoming contaminated, and the groundwater is then migrating into surface water. So it's actually acting as a transport vehicle. It's not delivering the contaminants from the source. It's basically becoming contaminated in the actual active zone. And these interfaces can be highly dynamic. So I'm just showing kind of the classic redox scale here, methanogenesis, sulfate reduction, iron, oxic near the surface. But that is by no means the only scenario you can get. Oftentimes, the surface is highly reduced because of sedimentation of organic matter at the interface. And so you can actually have aerobic or iron-reducing water that then becomes more reduced near the surface. And that redox chain is really important because it really can determine what's possible to happen to the contaminants. So in something like BTEX, obviously, if it's oxic, we're going to get aerobic degradation. BTEX could also degrade at other electron-accepting conditions, but it's certainly fastest at oxic. If we have sulfate being reduced to sulfide, that can basically sequester metals and make metal sulfides. If we have chlorinated solvents, another common groundwater contaminant, those are going to be most likely to degrade during under methanogenic conditions, highly reduced. And so understanding the redox condition in the interface in conjunction with the transport is critical if you're really going to understand what's going on. And oftentimes, all of this is occurring over centimeters, not feet, but centimeters. And so you need special tools to be able to evaluate it. So what do we need to know? Well, obviously one of the big things on a site assessment is where is the contaminant? X, Y, and Z locations. And so in this case, I'm using X and Y for area and Z for depth. So for groundwater, that might be tens to thousands of feet, large distances. In sediment, in terms of the area that's contaminated, it's usually smaller, not always, but usually. So we're, maybe tens to hundreds of feet in the X and Y direction. For the depth, groundwater obviously can be very large. I think probably more typical would be 10 to 100 feet. And sediment might be a few centimeters to maybe a meter. And so very different kind of depth profiles. You need to know where it's moving. Groundwater, high range of velocities, from essentially almost zero to maybe meters per day. Where in sediment, we're usually much lower, but not always, velocities. And that velocity is critical because what we're really interested in usually is a flux, not just a concentration. How much mass is migrating from the groundwater through the sediment into this surface water? So we need to know where, and we need to know how fast, as well as what the concentration is. We also want to know, does the contaminated water actually impact a receptor? Just because it's in the groundwater doesn't mean that it's actually getting to a receptor at a concentration of concern. So for groundwater, we normally do that with wells. We monitor over time. We're trying to make sure that the groundwater is not migrating to a drinking water well or to a property line. But for the sediment, we're talking about the biotic zone. Is the contamination getting to this biotic zone where we actually have organismal exposure? And that sometimes can be as small as 10 or 15 centimeters. And then finally, we need to know, is the contaminant transforming? Very, very often, if we get some type of transformation with contaminants, whether that's sequestration or oxidation or reduction. And in groundwater, that can happen over tens to hundreds of feet. In sediment, it often happens over centimeters. And so we need very different scales, very different tools to be able to evaluate the interface. So what tools are available? I'm not claiming this is an exhaustive list. It was just some of the ones that I've thought of and studies that I've been involved in. You know, obviously we have the wells. They're the kind of tried and true. We can have things put in the wells, passive flux meters. We can do low flow sampling. We can put passive samplers in. We have direct drive devices like point samplers and the membrane interface probe, hydraulic profiling tool. And then there's this high resolution passive profiler that I'm going to focus on just because that's what I have my own experience with. In sediments, commonly lysimeters, Triton probes are really useful, cores, and then again, lots and lots of kinds of passive samplers for sediments. So I'm just going to really briefly mention this. It's not a commercial, but a lot of the data that I'm going to show you was produced by this device. So I wanted you to have some idea of how it works. This is a device that we developed to be able to look at all these processes, velocity, concentration, geochemistry, even microbial populations, at a scale that was appropriate for the question. So in groundwater, that might be a feet, and in sediment, it might be centimeters. And it's a very simple device. Basically, there's a compartment. It's filled with water. Whatever in the pore water will migrate across a microporous membrane, will equilibrate with that water. We use bromide as a performance reference compound to know how close we got to equilibrium. It migrates out. So you stick this in the sediment or the groundwater, direct drive, no well involved. You leave it there for a few weeks. It equilibrates. You pull it out, and you can understand what the concentration is at every depth. And you can understand what the velocity is at every depth. So things like geochemical species, lots of different kinds of contaminants, PFAS, CVOCs, metals, perchlorate, other dissolved compounds. And then there's an estimate of pore water velocities as well. And so this is nice because we can actually get right at the interface. So, you know, here's a GeoPro putting one in a stream. There was a groundwater plume that was basically migrating. The owners were concerned that it was going to basically be discharging to the stream. So we can actually look at that interface. Is the contaminated groundwater actually migrating into the stream or not? This is a bay. This is actually the site I just showed you using a VibroCore to install one. This is a river in which there's a contaminated sediment with groundwater migrating through. And then just showing the field sampling. So first case study, trying to make it a little bit more interesting. This is Ashmont Pond. If you're into working PFAS, you may have heard about it. There's a PFAS plume that migrates down and it discharges into a small bay in this pond. And so we wanted to evaluate where was it discharging, how quickly was it discharging, was there transformation occurring? And so we basically put these samplers in an array. This is a 1 foot contour, a 3 foot contour, 4 foot, and 6 foot. And this is the general direction of what we thought the groundwater migration path was. And these are some onshore wells. So this is just a picture to kind of give you a scale. You can see the little bay, and all these buoys are where we have samplers out, except for the 1 foot line, which we didn't bother to put buoys because we could see them. I also want to point out again here, you can see the shore, right? And so this lake goes up and down by 2 to 4 feet. So when it's up, the groundwater would actually be, you know, somewhere over, the surface water would migrate all the way over to here. And when it's down, it might be out by this white line. And so there's a huge range of water levels that causes very big differences in groundwater flux and direction, and rapid changes in redox because of that. So this is a one visualization of the data we get. So basically, if I take all the data we got from these samplers, they were installed between 1 foot below sediment and 8 feet below sediment. And so the scales on these y-axis vary somewhat. And what I'm showing you here is a relative measure of sediment porosity. And so sediment porosity can be a strong indication of potential sorption, of impact on velocity, and even direction. And so Right now, I'm just trying to make a very simple point. You can see that there's kind of a low porosity zone in the middle at the 1 foot contour, and then at the 3 foot, 4 foot, and 6 foot contour, this side of the array, the upper right, has a low permeability zone somewhere between 10 centimeters and about 60 centimeters below the surface. So you can kind of see a low permeability zone on this far edge. And why is that important? Well, if we look, for instance, at PFOS concentrations, you can see the PFOS concentrations vary both with depth, 1 foot, 15 feet from shore, up to 120 feet from shore. We're going from, over 10,000 to basically non-detect. But you can also see that the highest concentrations overlap with that low permeability zone. So really high on that right edge, really high on the right edge, high in the center portion where we had a low permeability zone, and high on the right edge. And this is important because once we get into more detailed analysis, we'll see that that low porosity zone is actually acting as a reservoir. The contaminated groundwater migrating to the pond is not that high in concentration. It's actually decreased. But that low permeability zone has been loaded up over the years with PFOS and is now desorbing off and acting as a secondary source to the groundwater. Obviously, the flux, though, is going to be low. So while the concentration here may be high, the mass flux is going to be low because of that lower permeability. If we look at a little more detailed evaluation, so this is just one profile that I'm showing you. This is from the 6 foot water depth. And you can see that there's this peak concentration at about 30 centimeters, 30 to 40 centimeters below depth. And then it decreases. So the lower groundwater would be the source, but obviously the source can't be lower than the highest point. So that's what I'm talking about when I talk about how this low permeability zone is actually diffusing back off and acting as a source to the surface water. The other nice thing about getting these kind of detailed profiles, this is about 1 meter, and I've got 30 measurements, is that we can also look at transformation. So in this case, I'm showing you a precursor. This is a precursor to 6.2 FTS, and that precursor can break down into 6.2S. So it's not just that the 6.2 FTS is sorbed and acting as a source, but there's actually a parent compound that's resupplying the 6.2 FTS too. And so this is degrading to this. We can also see that with PFHXA, a terminal perfluorinated compound, in which the parent compounds are present and they're decreasing in concentration to produce this PFHXA. Second case study, this is the chlorinated solvent site that's migrating offshore. And so this study was actually done by Battelle. It's been presented at a previous conference, so I appreciate them letting me use the slide. Here's two kind of classic wells that were put in to evaluate that plume that's migrating off. We've got the red dots or Triton probes that were put in that allowed us to evaluate where we thought the chlorinated solvents would be migrating to. And then these big purple circles are the high-resolution samplers that we put in to really understand that migration and that transport. The triangles are shallow piezometers that went down to about 3 feet in that marsh area. And so you can see there was a lot of work done to try to understand this. I'm going to focus on the high-resolution samplers because I think it allows me to illustrate some of the important things that are occurring in that biotic zone and in the interface. So here we have a profile going into the sediment. So this is the sediment water interface, and this is depth below sediment from 0 centimeters to about 1.5 meters. And this is chloride, a really simple compound, but a really powerful compound that is a conservative tracer. So what you can see is we have a flat profile below about 15 centimeters at much lower salinity, as you would expect, so fresh water, fresher water. And then we have salt water at the surface. And over 15 centimeters, we're getting about a one order magnitude of reduction in chloride. So really rapid mixing, really large dilution that's occurring. And that's important because one, you can use this profile to understand the transport, the velocity, but you can also use it to understand the mixing that has to occur. And that mixing can decrease the concentrations of contaminant that could reach the surface. Redox profiles, here's sulfate, rapidly reducing. We have the green circles are methane. So we have a highly methanogenic zone about 30 centimeters below the surface. Really important for a chlorinated solvent because that methanogenic zone is going to increase the chances that we're getting reductive dechlorination. And then for DOC, you can see the DOC actually peaks below the surface at about 30 centimeters, which would make sense with the methanogenesis we're seeing. So we have food for the microorganisms that could be used to reduce the chlorinated solvent. And we can understand that all of that's occurring in this top 1 foot or 2 foot of the interface. Looking at the contaminant concentration, so these are the three circles that were near shore. This is the intermediate, and these three are offshore a little further. So this is essentially an array, and I'm showing the concentration with depth of chlorinated solvents. And one thing you can look at, I think it's very obvious, is this really rapid concentration decrease from about 2 meters to 1 meter. So this is about four orders of magnitude decrease in concentration as we move towards that interface. Some of that's probably due to degradation, but not all of it because we're really not seeing an increase in vinyl chloride consistently. We're only seeing a decrease in both vinyl and cis. So dilution. But the dilution is important because basically the chlorinated solvent is not reaching the top 1 meter, the top 30 centimeters or so, where we would expect that biotic zone to be, the benthic exposure. Other cases, we can actually see degradation. So here we have cis, we get a big increase in vinyl chloride. So we're able to show degradation. And then as we go farther out, here the plume is really not that large. It's not even really impacting much at this upper portion. It's very deep in the middle, so not even coming close to the sediment interface. And then as we move further down in the array, we're getting concentrations closer to the surface, but still three or four orders of magnitude decrease because of that rapid mixing we see in that zone. So all this to say that, really active process is occurring. The interface is critical, and having the right tool to look at the right resolution so you can understand whether the groundwater is really having an impact on surface water rather than just being present under it is really important. So a few lessons learned on groundwater interfaces, by no means extensive. There are many, many more. We get this really rapid dilution commonly near the interface. This is due to a lot of things: bank drainage, bank filling, refilling of surface water to groundwater can occur, tidal elevation changes, groundwater surface water elevation changes due to precipitation, enhanced mixing due to tidal pumping, and then these really extreme density gradients that can cause really rapid mixing. Those rapid changes can also impact redox, so which can impact metal availability or biodegradation that can occur. And those redox changes can actually change daily or even multiple times per day. So you can have redox zones that actually change throughout the day. And then there could be this really large spatial variation. Oftentimes, I find in groundwater studies, because often we use wells, we think that one well is going to tell us what's going to occur in kind of a pretty large area. But with sediment, the sediment can be so variable that you really need pretty high resolution sampling, both in the X and Y direction and the Z. The depth profiles can be highly impacted by the fine grain material, both due to sorption and also impact on hydrology. We can get changes in advective flux and direction, and then really localized areas of discharge. That Ashmont Pond is a great example of how there are some really high concentration zones beneath the pond near the surface, but they're not really impacting the pond because of very low fluxes. Whereas there's some lower concentrations near the shore, which have high advective fluxes that are impacting the pond more. So having all the information is really critical to understanding what's going on. And with that, just want to make some acknowledgments. I want to point out that my grad students did most of this work. I just talk about it. So Michaela and Morgan did some great work. Also Dr. Jennifer Guelfo and Dr. Todd Anderson at Texas Tech University. And then at APTIM, who did most of these studies with us, Dr. Paul Hatzinger and Greg Livorno. And I'd like to thank ESTCP and CERTP for funding this work over the many years we've been working on it.
Hey, thank you, Dr. Jackson, for that presentation. Very informative. And right now, it looks like there's only one question. And I'll go ahead and read the question. And Ray, if you can just let me know if any other questions pop up. But the question I'm seeing right now, Dr. Jackson, is What are the detection limits of passive samples for PFAS? Does this sampler evaluate total PFAS?
Yes. So the detection limits are basically the same for any water sample. We get to single digit nanogram per liter detection limits. We basically get enough water to be able to do a large volume injection in which we can meet the same criteria for most groundwater samples. We can look at both targeted and non-targeted species with that same sample. So all the data I showed you was from those passive samplers. And so, yes, we can also even do top on it if you're interested.
Very good. It looks like,
That's all we have. That's all we have right now.
So our other panelists of speakers, did you have anything for Dr. Jackson before we transition back to Kent to introduce our next speaker? All right, no additional questions for Dr. Jackson looking in the Q&A room, looking at our other panelists. No questions for Dr. Jackson, so I'll go ahead and turn it back over to Kent.
Thank you. Looking forward to seeing how some of Andrew, some of your thoughts regarding the scale of measurement and so forth translate into our next speaker, actually, and our final speaker. I see some interesting opportunities for some discussion coming up. At any rate, our next presentation is by Martin Briggs. Dr. Briggs works with the USGS, and he's based at the University of Connecticut. Marty's responsibilities include conducting field and data analysis projects across the U.S., hydrogeophysical methods development, and training activities. In addition to his USGS responsibilities, he is adjunct faculty at the University of Connecticut and typically co-advises several graduate students along with ongoing research collaborations with EPA. The overarching theme of Marty's research has been quantifying how and where groundwater and surface waters are connected using innovative measurement technologies and analysis techniques. Marty's widely published, holds geology and hydrology degrees from the University of Massachusetts and Colorado School of Mines, which is something we share, and a PhD from Syracuse University. So please welcome Dr. Martin Briggs, who will be talking with us today about a method and decision support toolbox for assessing groundwater surface water interactions. Marty, go ahead.
Okay, thanks a bunch, Kent. Can you guys hear me okay? Okay, I'm gonna get rolling with my slide deck. Please, someone shout if you don't see my slides. Wanted to make you aware of this decision support toolbox. It's a spreadsheet-based software. It's been available for a few years now, but I've found, working with various people across the country on groundwater surface water exchange studies, characterization, ranging from applied to research, that the awareness of this toolbox is low. So I'm hoping to change that a bit today and also indicate we've got some updates in the works funded by ESTCP that are focused directly on questions related to contaminant transport, mass loading that aren't directly in the toolbox now, which is mostly based on general study goals, characterizing groundwater surface water exchange processes and site characteristics. But the new functionality of the toolbox that we expect to be available within the next 6 months will incorporate specific goals and considerations related to contaminant transport at the interface. So I'm Marty Briggs. I'm with the USGS Hydrologic Remote Sensing Branch of the Water Mission Area. I'm based in the Northeast, and there's been contributions to this work from a number of folks. The development of the toolbox was primarily through Dale Workman at the EPA, and then the updates funded by ESTCP, as well as kind of broad demonstration of various elements of the toolbox, so methods being used in conjunction and trying to better understand which methods work best together to add value and which methods maybe are not applicable to certain sites and certain questions. And we did that recently at several Navy sites across the country. So If you want to use this toolbox, it's publicly available. I'll provide the URL at the end of the presentation, and it's basically a spreadsheet. We want to make this kind of as straightforward as possible and both be a resource to understanding what methods might be out there, but also do some front-end planning on what methods might be most applicable to study goals and site characteristics. You know, Andrew Jackson, we didn't actually coordinate our presentations directly, but he sets up this topic very well for a few different reasons. One, he had a slide that said, what tools are available? And mentioned that, you know, it's not an exhaustive list. And I'm also not going to claim that this toolbox is exhaustive, but, you know, generally the methods we deploy are methods that we've developed or we've worked with folks that have deployed successfully, you know, maybe somewhat from the literature and seeing presentations at various meetings, but it's, you know, human beings are kind of opportunistic that way. We might not have a full understanding of what's out there or a great understanding of what methods are most applicable. Sometimes things seem kind of shiny and new and folks want to try them, particularly when it comes to, I think, geophysics and drones, but they may not really have a chance of working based on the site characteristics or the study questions or both. And the tool in a simple way helps suss that out. It covers 26 distinct physical, chemical, geophysical, and drone-based methods. It's framed around three general hydrologic settings, those being streams and rivers in the terrestrial domain, lake and wetlands, and then the coastal domain, estuary and coastal groundwater. Andrew mentioned tidal pumping can be a big deal, and I'll mention that at the end of this presentation. So just for methods awareness and quick reference, I think the tool is very useful. So even if you don't have an impending study where you know your study goals and your site characteristics, just for viewing the methods using the toolbox as a resource, as I do time to time, I think is useful because we set this up so each method out of 26 methods has an individual slide, shows a picture of what it looks like being deployed at least at one or two sites somewhere in the country. This example in the upper right is FloTEM, so that's a time domain EM tool that we tow behind a boat. Can image down to about 100 meters, depending on site conditions, you know, the EM profile. And we create 2D transects over, you know, we've done 80 kilometer transects in the Columbia River with this tool. So it's kind of a larger domain tool. And then the interpretation, we usually have an indication what the interpretation of the data will look like on each slide. In this case, showing, you know, a distribution of interpreted sand versus clay. And I think we're all aware of what the, you know, the preferential flow in sand between groundwater and surface water, as opposed to clay, why that would be important to map. And there's also what we see as key references that are indicated in the slide and then summarized on a final slide in the methods tool if you wanted to kind of do further reading on the nuts and bolts of the tool and see where they've been applied in detail. Here's another example. You know, I'm a big fan of vertical bed temperature profiling that we typically use to estimate groundwater surface water exchange fluxes over time. So that's a vertical Darcy flux from the sediment to the surface water or the other way around. In this case, we showed an example of some analysis software. This is one example from the USGS. There's several analysis softwares out there. And this is a good example of one of the slides that's going to be updated within the next 6 months to include, you know, the several new methods that have been published since 2022 when we released this tool. And finally, just one more of these examples for drone-based or methodology, this case showing multispectral data collected on a Pacific atoll, as well as in Western Colorado to indicate, you know, plants that are stressed either by saltwater intrusion or aridity that can both indicate kind of preferential groundwater surface water exchange processes at the landscape scale using kind of new data types that we weren't so typical for groundwater surface water exchange studies in the past. Now, my case study example, again, plays off Andrew's quite well because it's just a few kilometers to the east of Ashumet Pond, that first example he showed, which is adjacent to Joint Base Cape Cod, which has a long history of you know, kind of basic study in advective dispersive hydrology, as well as contaminant transport. In this case, you know, we've moved on to characterizing PFAS from numerous known and unknown sources that tends to exchange with kettle ponds, which are glacial groundwater flow through ponds. Several of these ponds don't have defined inlets and outlets. So you have groundwater coming in generally along one shoreline that's in the upgradient, you know, aquifer side and then out the other side. this case, we're in a wetland around the Quashnet River that drains John's Pond, which again is just east of a Schumann Pond. So there's numerous lakes that these plumes, you know, narrow plume comes into a lake, exchange, eventually comes out the other side with a, at a different concentration and a wider plume. We've got convergence of regional flow paths at these wetlands. You know, there's peat deposits are very low hydraulic connectivity, up to 6-8 meters thick in some of these kettle hole peatlands that tend to drive convergence of flow paths at preferential groundwater discharge zones that have very high invective rates and then mass transfer rates of various contaminants. So we're trying to source out, you know, using various conceptual models, what are most applicable to the you know, transport of PFAS to this ecosystem. So here's a schematic of just some of the known sources. You know, the gray area is the base. Some just very basic groundwater flow modeling indicating those orange lines are transport north to south toward various receptors. The Schumann Pond being on the left, that bottom left blue area, and then Moody Pond on the right, a smaller pond, just up gradient of the wetland system I mentioned. So the potential is there. And of course, we need to get out in the field and measure these things and refine our understanding from these kind of more basic model predictions. Now, the kind of naive assumption we started with was, you know, we've got narrow known plumes of PFAS, you know, various sources on the base intersecting some of these ponds. You know, you're mixing the ponds are generally shallow and you know, they stratify in the summer for sure, but mix under high, you know, wind events and seasonally, that what's coming out the other side may be of lower concentration than what's coming in these narrow plumes and may be somewhat predictable. We found that quickly that was not the case finding seeps then down gradient in the wetland that are influenced by the pond, you know, finding concentrations that were kind of all over the map, some, you know, 2 to 3 times high what we ever observed in the pond water. We've inferred that that's due in part to reactions of PFAS precursors at these highly reactive interfaces in the kind of pond muck. And some of the tools described in the toolbox help us figure that out, as I'll show. So now we just need to kind of reorient ourselves. This is a profile in 2D, just basically a slice through the aquifer, just up gradient of the wetland. We have the good fortune here for the Massachusetts USGS office and the Air Force spent a lot of time and money putting in multi-level samplers and sampling for, in this case, PFAS and stable water isotopes. And we can use that information in conjunction to infer these various zones. So what we're looking at here is we're looking into the upgrading aquifer. So flow would be toward you, toward the screen, coming into the wetland, converging at some of these high flow seeps. So top, based on the combination of water isotopes and PFAS, we see stuff that's lake influence, high in PFAS. So that's several hundred nanogram per liter, at least in terms of total PFAS, which is the sum of six kind of primary compounds we observe there. And then below that, we see a broad zone that's not lake influenced apparently by the water isotope signatures, but high in PFAS. So potentially flow paths coming from further up in the base that pass below the shallow pond. Then even deeper, you know, tens of meters below, we see water that's not lake influenced, low in PFAS. And then even further below that, again, lake influenced water, probably another lake even higher up on the aquifer mound. Again, low in PFAS, probably coming from above the lake. So we see we have this potential for this extreme complexity in flow paths that's going to end up, you know, in this, a lot of this in this wetland at the groundwater surface water interface at these preferential groundwater discharge zones. So back to the tool. This is what the input looks like. It's these input questions are mainly yes and no. Some are, you know, more quantitative related to the study and the site. And so you can see goals are, you know, what are the goals of your study? These are kind of high-level objectives that are very typical of groundwater surface water exchange studies. You know, identify zones of preferential groundwater exchange, map thermal variability, map vegetation stress, long-term monitoring of exchange. So things of that nature. And those are yes, no. And then there's project site parameters that in conjunction with the goals help identify methods that might be most useful and ones that may not add a whole lot of value. Some of these examples are, do you expect strong upward flow through the bed, strong downward flow through the bed, but also kind of very practical things. Is there vegetation growing along the bottom of the interface or along the interface that you intend to deploy the instrumentation? Are there wind-driven waves? What's the spatial scale you're interested in? Is there boat access? So just some very practical things that come together to, you know, essentially make numerous methods impractical at many of our sites. And this is what the output would look like. So the input and actually kind of coded into the spreadsheet that you might download is this example from the Quashnet River bogs that I'm talking about. So if you, you know, if you access the software, you'll see this follows my presentation pretty well. We could see that almost all methods here are shown to be potentially applicable. It didn't turn out to be that they all worked well. You know, this tool, like anything, is not infallible. But then we can also see more detail on what's suitable, what's appropriate for the goals, what maybe is effective at the site. So you can kind of zoom in at some of these radio buttons, and then actually specific, you know, goal by goal, you know, that A through N column indicates, you know, this is the method that's applicable to that specific, you know, aspect of your goal. Yellow is kind of used with caution, and there's some kind of disclaimers at the bottom that those yellow zones point to. And then there's also methods made infeasible by site parameter. So we have that kind of explicitly showing up. So you don't just get a black button that says this method is not feasible, that you get some information on why. And it may be that the basic questions we have here are a little too rigid and they don't cover your site well. And you could kind of overrule that and say, well, I do think this would work here because, you know, the question didn't really capture my site perfectly. So some demonstration of these methods ranging from simple to more complex at this site, because I think this, of course, makes it all a little more real. You know, using some of these methods that the tool indicated would work well, you know, in summer and winter, we expect very strong contrast between groundwater temperature, which is about 10 to 12 degrees year round, and surface water temperature, which ranges up to 25 to 30 degrees. The example on the left, this is marching down about 5 kilometers of the stream below John's Pond. The base and the PFAS sources would be to the north of these plots. This is just a very simple, but I think underused method, is taking the temperature of the bed. You know, this could be in the intertidal zone. It could be a lake bed. In this case, it's a small stream. In a snapshot in time. So we try to find a time when temperature is not changing too quickly. Late afternoon in the summer is a great time, or early morning in the winter. We maximize the temperature gradient between groundwater and surface water. And the blue dots indicate zones of probable strong groundwater discharge. Yellows and reds are warmer, indicate more conductive heat exchange, or places where either the stream might be losing water, which wouldn't be typical here, or there's just not strong groundwater exchange for various reasons. You know, lack of a hydraulic gradient, and or low permeability sediments. Now that pairs really well in this case with the handheld thermal infrared. So the pink dots are basically strong thermal anomalies we saw with infrared. And, you know, infrared does not penetrate the water surface, as you're probably aware. So we're really looking for places where there's enough groundwater discharge, it doesn't mix away in time to impact the surface water temperature. And so we often apply this method in winter when groundwater is relatively warm and buoyant compared to cold surface water. Or places along the bank or right at the waterline that are somewhat exposed and maintain that groundwater signature at the point of discharge. And you can see those clusters of pinks match up pretty well with what we're measuring in the bed. So now we're capturing what's observable along the banks, as well as what's out in the middle of the stream that we might not capture with the infrared camera. And, you know, if you're not familiar with this methodology, it's just, you know, kind of very simple contrasting temperatures of, in this case, warm groundwater in winter and much colder surface water. Great time to do this is when there's a little bit of snow or frost on the landscape. And if the sun is not directly on the landscape, the warm spots are very indicative and unique to groundwater discharge. And that's not the only parameter we're gonna use to confirm that this is a seep. We'll often make then direct bed temperature measurements at the thermal anomalies indicated by the temperature. And we'll look for other indicators. In this case, watercress tends to grow directly at strong groundwater discharge zones. We see accumulation of iron oxides, indicative of suboxic to anoxic groundwater discharge, that all come together for us to put out our flag and say, this is a very likely zone of groundwater discharge that's focused in space, and we're going to sample for PFAS. We're going to try to quantify water flux rates over time and think about mass fluxes. Let's see. Here's another scale of an example of paired air water temperature methods that you may be less familiar with. You know, these are also described in detail in the spreadsheet tool, where we're going to collect data over time within the stream channel, as well as the local air temperature, and we compare those signals. We can compare daily signals, kind of monthly, daily average temperatures, or annual signals, and infer areas that are in general more groundwater influenced and less groundwater influenced, as shown here at the, you know, this is the 5 kilometer scale. So again, gives us a place to monitor over time and kind of zoom in on. I think these are particularly useful for areas of kind of constant loading of groundwater for cold water habitat studies and contaminant transfer studies. Back to direct bed temperature measurements, you know, Andrew mentioned there's places along these Kettle Lakes where groundwater kind of comes in and is focused along the shoreline. Again, we just walked around this lake in a few hours, measuring temperature at 15 centimeters depth, and we could create a quick map of where the indicative groundwater discharge zone, those blue dots, where groundwater is then recharging in back into the aquifer in this small Moody Pond kettle, just down gradient of the base. So this allows us to then target our sampling. So we can put, you know, small piezometers right into these apparent groundwater discharge areas to see what's coming in. We can measure the lake water to see kind of what's this more mixed surface water concentration. And we could also make measurements in the downwelling zones on the far side of the lake to say what's actually coming out and going back into the aquifer that may be influenced by lake bed reactions. Thermal terrain mapping with drones. So this is basically imaging of the terrain, typically used to create these ortho products that are georeferenced, that have the topography. We can overlay thermal on the visual to kind of give ourselves a better understanding. I think they're super useful for groundwater surface water studies conducted in wetlands where it's really hard to get around and have a perspective on the system. They may be less useful in, you know, small forested headwaters and some coastal settings, as I'll talk about in a few minutes. But very useful typically in wetlands at times when you have strong contrast in surface and groundwater temperature if you're using a, you know, heat tracing based methodology. And here are two examples from orthomosaics. So these are hundreds of thousands of individual ortho images or thermal images collected by the drone in 2019, which was contracted by the town. 2022 was our study, the same area. We see these same general hotspots in winter, indicating strong groundwater discharge, good places to sample and quantify flux rates. We also had some issues here where, you know, just the trees warming up in sunlight very early in the morning, just right after daybreak, even though the air temperature was below freezing, look a lot like groundwater if you don't know they're trees. And in this case, we were constrained to flying the drone only during daylight hours because we were so close to the base and near other flight lines. That wouldn't necessarily be a constraint elsewhere. So that's the kind of nuance that's not included in the tool, but, you know, it points you in the right direction of what drone methods might be useful. And we found that, you know, while the drone-based heat tracing was useful in the winter, it wasn't very useful in the summer because there was too much vegetation and groundwater was cold and tended to plunge and not make an anomaly at the surface. But another method the tool indicated would be useful and we found was accurate here was this fiber optic distributed temperature data. So we laid out fiber optic cables that are temperature sensitive with half meter resolution. And this showed, you know, cold zones where there were warm zones in winter indicated by the drone, but also really allowed us to pinpoint these high flow preferential seeps that were at the half meter or less scale. And then, you know, make measurements directly there about contaminant fluxes into the system. So finally, we can put all these, you know, methods together that the tool indicated would be useful. Most of them worked well. EM tools, even though the tool indicated might be useful here, didn't work well. Electromagnetic tools, because we didn't have much contrast between surface and groundwater electrical conductivity, and there wasn't much zonation in electrical conductivity of the pore water to the subsurface. So without contrast, geophysical methods don't actually produce much. So it's not that the tools didn't work, the site parameters just were not amenable. And we didn't know that a priori, and so there's certainly some ambiguity there. But we're able to generate a map of, in this case, you know, 40 or 50 high flux zones, discharge zones from groundwater surface water that we can study in detail over time. We can refine our conceptual model of how those develop using these various data types. And then we can make, you know, measurements directly at these locations. And this is another example of where one of the tools that the method selection toolbox indicated would work really well, vertical temperature profiling to quantify vertical flux rates, didn't work well. And I was very surprised by this at first and realized that because there was such hot, strong groundwater discharge rate, you know, upwards of 3 meter per day vertical flux rates, And they tend to pool, and this was a relic cranberry farm, pool in these drainage ditches. So there was a very cold surface boundary condition, just very little thermal variability that penetrated the subsurface. And the models just, you know, they didn't have much to work with, right? It was basically isothermal. So we had to go back and use, you know, kind of more very physical methods, manometer, vertical head gradients, physical seepage meters. That doesn't give us as much information over time, but it did make us feel better about the vertical flux rates of groundwater surface water that we were measuring. So this is just kind of a map of what were the bulk PFAS concentrations in winter and summer at all these locations. So now that we know where these zones of high flux are, we can do something with them. If we don't, before we know that, you know, we're just synoptic sampling that's kind of ill-informed by the system, we're probably going to miss these points of strong mass flux. Now, this is pretty interesting. So the outflow from John's Pond, which again is just to the east of Ashumet Pond, there is an outflow that was, it was cut actually for herring passage by the colonials, you know, hundreds of years ago. It wasn't natural for this kettle to have an outlet there. But that is the feeds the top of the stream, and we can just go along the stream and measure discharge in the surface water. These are good places for differential gauging, and measure PFAS concentration and get a load. And we can see what that curve, or, you know, what that load profile looks like throughout the wetland. So we're going along the stream here in winter. So you can see the leaving John's Pond and then basically the outflow of the bog, about a kilometer transport. What it looks like in summer, you know, correcting for the masses coming out of the pond, they're very similar, winter and summer conditions. And then interestingly, there was a regional drought in 2022 where the stream disconnected from John's Pond. So there's no water coming out of the pond. And the mass loading profile at that time looked almost exactly the same as the other two seasons. So it was pretty interesting to us that even though we were seeing kind of changes in flux rates due to changes in water table elevation, changes in pond elevation, the net result in terms of export of PFAS mass out of this wetland was pretty similar with distance along the stream. Now, I'm just going to kind of wrap up here. So, you know, we've got all these methods. I showed you an example where several methods worked well together. What's up with these tabs for different hydrologic settings? Like, you know, this is kind of a naive question, but why might it matter so much that we have broken it out this way? You know, between stream, river, lake or wetland, estuary or coastal? Well, let's look at the coastal domain. So this is just nearby Rhode Island, Navy landfill, right basically on the beach, concerns about leachate. This is another orthomosaic that we thought this method would work quite well based on some handheld imaging. And we found out it was very hard to interpret, because it takes a few hours potentially to fly a larger site. These are thousands of images where we get this composite thermal ortho, and there's tides moving all the time. There's ocean currents that are changing the surface water temperature that may not at all reflect these kind of relatively small areas of groundwater discharge. So, you know, what we might think are these, if we were in a wetland, I would say, oh, those purples are probably big plumes of groundwater. In fact, I think they're just kind of tidal exchange. And the locations we care about, we could find with a handheld camera kind of point in time. So we could shift what methods we use from the drone here. Maybe a flyover video or hovering just above the beach area would have been better here than trying to create an ortho that took hours to collect, because we can clearly see there's thermal signatures of focused groundwater discharge. And we'll see if this plays for you. But this is, you know, one example of a driver of tidal pumping. We've got these strong, very focused in space groundwater discharges. You know, the spatial scale of those blue areas is less than a half meter across. Tides coming in, changing the hydraulic gradient, potentially pushing surface water into the subsurface. In this case, the towed electrical resistivity and EM methods worked really well because, no surprise, there's strong contrast between saline ocean water and even the leachate coming from the groundwater of the landfill. So since we had contrast, these methods worked better, and that was indicated by the tool. EM methods showed something very similar. There's an example of one of them being deployed via a kayak that someone's walking right along the beach, and you can see the riprap wall of the landfill there. And I'll just end on a tidal pumping example. You know, I'm actually on Cape Cod studying this process today, trying to measure PFAS flux rates in the intertidal zone as impacted by tides, as impacted by changing redox. And in this case, you know, we deployed, it was pretty hard to deploy a seepage meter in the waves. You can't deploy them when it's exposed at low tide. They need to be submerged. So our vertical temperature profile methods and new modeling methods are very useful here in indicating shifts from strong upwelling to slight downwelling at high tide. So strong upwelling at low tide, strong downwelling at high tide, just based on those changes to the hydraulic gradient driven by the, you know, the depth of water above the seepage zones. So to wrap up, you know, I think this, we could all probably do more on the front end of these projects to just reassess what methods are most applicable and kind of break the mode of using either what we're most comfortable with or what we've seen recently that, you know, we feel is kind of shiny and new. And then once the local data starts to be collected or we learn more about the site, we can refine, you know, the output. And while it's simple and certainly not infallible, this does harness kind of the, you know, the career experience of 10 USGS and EPA subject matter experts. So the URL is located there for the software. And there's also a nice little paper that kind of describes and has another couple of case studies that describes the tool. Thank you.
Hey, thank you very much, Dr. Griggs. We appreciate it. I'm not showing any questions for you in the Q&A room. So what I would like to do is see if any of our panelists had questions for Dr. Briggs before we transition to Kent. I'll give it a couple of seconds to see if any of the panelists had any questions or comments or something they want to, you know, emphasize for Dr. Briggs' presentation. Okay, hearing none. And looking at the Q&A room, there's no questions, so I will turn it back over to Kent.
All righty. Marty's presentation did kind of trigger a long, convoluted question, or maybe a couple questions kind of interrelated. And I thought about holding this question until the end of the third presentation today, but I'll throw it out there now just so that we can get maybe a little bit of thought into it as we work through Trey's presentation. And I'm thinking from the perspective, I'm very, very parochial here, very focused on Air Force type needs and concerns and so on. And so my perspective is needing to understand migration pathways and identifying locations for response actions across a site or across a plume, right? So it's sort of a plume or site scale concern. And the question is how important it is to characterize the fine scale variability that Andrew Jackson talks so much about, and which is very interesting. How important is it to characterize that variability in redox and other geochemical characteristics? Is it sufficient to demonstrate that the critical controls that those kinds of fine scales are operable and maybe understand something about them sort of in a just demonstrating that the processes are there at your site or is it important to characterize and how do you go about mapping variability within reasonable time scales and budgets across an entire site or plume? In other words, I'm kind of interested in what all three speakers' thoughts are on how one balances fine scale measurement techniques with, you know, techniques that some of which Marty talked about, more conventional or larger scale techniques. So I just throw that out there. It's kind of a broad, nebulous question. I haven't formed it well, but that's what you're presentation kind of triggered in my head after hearing Andrew. And so I don't know if you two want to talk about that now, or you want to talk about that at the end after we give Trey a chance to give his presentation. What do you think?
I can comment on that quickly. You know, it's one thing we learned through the study that the case study I showed was that, you know, down gradient of the small kettle lake, we had water that looked like it was coming out of the lake and not influenced by other groundwater based on the water isotopic signature, but relatively high PFAS concentrations that we never measured in the lake. And that led us to look at, you know, specific compounds, precursors, and come to the conclusion that there's probably reactions that are happening at the lake bed at very fine scales that are important in driving mass flux of PFAS to the wetland. So we can then go in and change our study design to actually incorporate these kind of centimeter scale processes in the lake bed that we never intended to study.
And so then your thought is that that's important if you're going to try and ultimately make some good decision on where and how to do cleanup, huh?
I think so, because in this case, we realized that the precursors were bringing a lot of mass in that we weren't kind of aware of and considering, and that would be considered then in a remediation plan.
Yeah.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I think that all the methods are both useful and needed. You can start with surveys to help figure out where you want to do more intensive evaluations, and that is really appropriate and useful. You can also do kind of different screenings. You can start off with some high resolution data, but not look at everything. And then as you find things that are interesting, go back with those same samples and do more analysis. But I think you got to consider the whole toolbox always, and you got to use all the tools in the right manner if you're going to do it efficiently, but also thoroughly. You kind of need multiple tools.
Yeah, the challenge, of course, is doing that in a environment where funds are limited and sites are multiple, right?
Yep.
Yeah. So maybe our final speaker will shed some light on that concept as well, and other concepts. So maybe we move.
We did have one.
Okay, great.
Question.
Great. We've got time.
So the question is, will the improved MST remove the need for macros?
Possibly. TBD. That's actually originally we were thinking no, but given just the advancements and how this could be done recently, we're determining now if that would indeed be the case. So I guess we'll have to stay tuned.
Gotcha. All right.
Can I ask a follow up to that? We've seen we got a couple minutes here, if you don't mind, Jay, RJ. Yeah. This is from Artie. As inevitably happens, we all get tunnel vision to some degree. So suppose that somebody's sitting out there that thinks they've got some technique or method for characterization that isn't in the toolbox, and that maybe you and the other 9 subject matter experts that have been involved aren't aware of. What do they do?
That's actually that's a neat question. Email me or Fred Day Lewis or somebody on that list for sure. It's something that we'd love to be aware of if we're not, and perhaps certainly include it. Our intention now is to kind of keep this thing better updated. There haven't been any updates since 2022 for various reasons, but the world moves quickly, right, in terms of methods development.
Yeah,
and even right. Just the broad types of methods we showed, the software that supports those methods have changed substantially in 4 years. So we want to keep that better current, and we'd love to hear from folks that have ideas and methods that could be included here.
And maybe that's something for our FRTR steering committee to think about, is how we can help you get the word out.
That'd be great.
Yeah.
There is a question in the Q&A. Where will the toolbox link be available, or when will a toolbox link be available?
I had it on my last slide, the URL where it's available. You can also just kind of Google the USGS Groundwater Surface Water Toolbox, and you'll get there very quickly, as well as the supporting paper. But I don't know if I can post it in the general chat, JR, or something like that.
Oh, JR, you're on mute.
Yes, that's fine.
Okay.
And then there's a statement too. PFAS is a unique contaminant of concern in that it has two parts, one half hydrophobic and the other half hydrophilic. It was just a statement, I guess, that was made in the Q&A. I don't know if you need to chime in on that, but just reading that out to you.
Okay.
That's all we've got, JR. Thank you.
So back over to Kent.
All righty. So our final formal presentation for this afternoon is from Everett Fortner, known to friends and colleagues as Trey. And Mr. Fortner is a subject matter expert hydrogeologist at NOPLIS. He specializes in quantitative hydrogeological assessments that support conceptual site model development, contaminant fate transport analysis, remediation, strategy design. And he's led multiple initiatives to develop comprehensive data management strategies, including solutions for large scale data sets. His expertise includes groundwater hydraulics, high resolution in situ instrumentation, data visualization, and advanced analytics to refine conceptual site models and optimize remediation approaches. I've come to know Trey over the last few years through his work focused on understanding PFAS and other contaminants, and have greatly appreciated both his skill and creative problem solving to address complex remediation challenges at Air Force facilities. And so today, Trey is going to describe a systematic framework for addressing GSI characterization challenges that I think bookends nicely with the presentation just provided by Marty Briggs. And so with that introduction, please welcome Mr. Fortner.
All right. Thank you, Kent. Appreciate it. Mm-hmm. Hello, everyone. Thanks for having me. So today I'll be going through... Oh, I guess we need to get the slides up. Shelley, Thank you.
We're seeing them now.
Okay. I think I have control now. Are we in presentation mode so I can advance, or?
While you're working on that, Trey, you get the prize today for the most interesting title.
Thanks. All right, looks like I can advance now. Okay. Thank you. So as I was saying, I'm going to talk about a process we developed for implementing GSI investigations and how to keep them on track. As the title says, from rocky seas to smooth sailing, where will your path take you? I think that what I'll be walking through today aligns nicely, as Kent was saying, with the previous two presentations, and you'll actually see some overlapping areas, some common themes as well. A quick thank you to my co-authors, Annie Neiman with APCEC and Amar Wanhawan with Novus, who helped me and supported this content. Okay, our agenda, here's what I want you to walk away with today. There's three things. One, what are the challenges, and outline the needs for an approach to set up your GSI investigation. Two, how to build a CSM that accounts for GSI specific items. So that's like, building a strong investigation team, and select appropriate methods, to which Dr. Briggs was talking about, that match your site setting and constraints. And three, show you how this looks like in practice through a case study. That way we can compare what worked and what to improve based off of what we're presenting. And what we'll walk through today is simple. This isn't about adding complexity. We already know that GSI investigations are highly complex, but it's about managing it so that your results are defensible, efficient through every phase, and that every phase moves the project forward toward your end goals. The drawing that you see on the right here shows calm waters in a harbor setting. As an analogy, that's where we want to be with our GSI investigations. There are two objectives. First, a systematic framework for tackling the common GSI challenges at PFAS or legacy contamination sites through phased investigation approach and, of course, robust CSM development. The second is GSI method selection. That aligns with your site conditions and your investigation goals, not just what's convenient or familiar to you, or throwing something at the wall and see what sticks. So whether you're scoping your initial GSI investigation or you're refining one that is ongoing, this process you'll find is simple. It's repeatable. You can apply it again and again. And it's built from lessons learned and from real experiences and some published literature. Okay, first, I think I missed a slide. There, some background here. So let's start with why this matters. Okay, on the left, we see the challenges. We have multiple sources, complex transport pathways, scale and heterogeneity issues, and the unique complexity that comes with PFAS being released into the environment. Now we bridge that to the right, where we have an approach to that challenge, those challenges, a phased framework, a qualified team, a systematic process, and a focus on quality. And in reality, we know that that these investigations are complex. However, we also need to understand that we're dealing with systems that are dynamic. Water levels change, plume shift, sources overlap. And if the process isn't built to handle those dynamic conditions, then you end up chasing the data instead of answering the questions that were set forth. And yes, I should mention that sometimes our results come back as could be inconclusive, but that doesn't mean that you walk away with nothing. The data can still be used or still be mined for what didn't work. And then you can pull that out and see what it can tell you. And then that can guide the next phase of investigation, for example. But that's why we need a process is to, built to handle the complexity that we see and not to avoid it. Next, the challenges. We'll look at this in a little bit more detail. The multiple sources are we have widespread distribution, like I said, commingled plumes, often active ongoing source leaching that's occurring as well. Those complications often bring up many other problems, and we can't typically just draw a line from one source to one receptor. And you might have, many sources, many potential sources that's contributing that mass discharge to just one surface water body or many surface water bodies. The pathways, we're not just dealing with groundwater discharging to surface water. We have, local storm sewers. We have discharges into the surface water bodies. We have under, those storm sewers could also be both underground and/or open ditch, seeps. PFAS wind-driven transport, hyporheic zone mixing, and of course the complex geochemistry interactions that Dr. Jackson was talking about. And these pathways don't operate in isolation. They also, have a dynamic way of interacting together. So that's again adding more complexity. One example is a storm sewer might come through your site and short circuit your expected groundwater flow path by introducing a preferential pathway. Or let's say a surface water body sediment, might act as an attenuation to some incoming flux of concentrations in one area, but in another area, there's enhanced flow and therefore enhanced concentration flux going into the surface water body. Going to scale and heterogeneity, spatial variability, we definitely have seasonal and storm event fluctuations that are occurring. And I can't express it enough. One of the most common issues that I see is teams not treating hydrologic systems as dynamic. They're capturing a lot of data that are snapshots that do not inherently get the important fluctuations that are occurring over time. So that's one aspect that we need to think about when we're collecting data. It's just not where, but it's also when. And then we have the unique PFAS complexity, different ionic forms with varying transport characteristics. We have complex partitioning, low screening levels, the PFAS absorption to sediments that it's occurring, the precursor transformation, of course, across the whole migration pathway. And all these add layers and complications to a GSI investigation. So the question here, how do you design an investigation that accounts for all this without becoming unmanageable? And that's where our approach comes in to help alleviate these situations and help teams out. There it goes. Okay. And it starts with your team. You need highly talented and highly skilled hydrogeologists, hydrologists as well, along with subject matter experts, according to the specific methodologies that you might be using, project and, of course, data managers. These are the people, these are the strong, highly skilled staff members that can help you evaluate a CSM and move through identified data gaps and different phases of investigation. And to emphasize here that the team strength comes first, and that's before the methods and before data collection. Next is the phased investigation approach. Starting small, you break down the complexity of the site. You address the data gaps iteratively. Don't try to tackle every question with just one mobilization. And this process requires, of course, an aligned scope of work. You're collaborating with your stakeholders, you have regulatory coordination, and you have clear, established data quality objectives. Everyone knows the questions and the best and how best to answer them. And then the quality outcomes. Defensible findings, efficient resource use, regulatory acceptance, and data that supports your next decision. Okay, here's the roadmap. First, you develop your team. You review the baseline CSM, define the system before you investigate it. There will be likely many GSI data gaps that you'll find missing from the baseline CSM. You develop your scope of work, select your methods, use strategic tools like the MST, identify appropriate scale, optimal timing, collect your data, then you evaluate it, update your CSM, learn from it, identify the remaining data gaps, and that cycle continues until your goals are met. And this builds on an established framework authored by Conant and others that was published in 2019 in the Journal of Hydrology. Their work includes a ranking system that prioritizes the most significant processes at your site. So that framework pushes right straight into what we're presenting today, to which is a more practical and repeatable process for investigation teams to implement. And then next here, over the next few slides, I'll be focusing in on the baseline CSM and other CSM elements for GSI, scope of work, and the method selection. Okay, our CSM essentials here on the left, some aspects for a typical baseline CSM. You have climate, source area, plume extent, hydrogeology, understanding, groundwater flow direction. That's pretty standard, but it's usually not sufficient for GSI studies, so we need a bit more. So we move through these data gaps over to what's on the right, where we have some critical elements defined, surface water hydrology, preferential pathways, hydraulic connection evidence, background water quality, mass flux and discharge, temporal and spatial variability. There's many others. And of course, PFAS-specific characterization that was talked about before. We have to, worry about precursor transformation, precursors as sources and mass flux, seasonal concentration variation, of course, and other things for surface water, such as foam formation and transport. So we can look at some of these in a little bit more detail. One of the things we can look at is hydraulic connection evidence. Do you have multiple lines of evidence that supports that the groundwater is discharging to the surface water body or vice versa? And over what time frames and areas? So those are really good questions to ask yourself for your goals. That moves right straight into the temporal and spatial variability. Your system behaves differently in the summer versus the winter. And we know that those dynamic fluctuations, especially after intense rain events or storm events, I should say, that really increases discharge and it can expand concentrations extent. And then we got to look at the anthropogenic influences. So as I mentioned before, the stormwater infrastructure is really important. Discharges or withdrawals from surface water bodies. Where are the impervious surfaces located? And all these can actually alter some of the natural flow patterns and are often overlooked. And finally, here, if your CSM falls short, your investigation starts on an unstable ground. So that often leads to missteps, inconclusive results, and what we don't like is wasted resources. So moving on to the scope of work. Once a solid CSM is in place and you have a strong team ready to go, you define your research questions, identify the data gaps, set your investigation goals, and select your preliminary methods. And this is where the DQO process, the data quality objectives, come into play and are important. You're just not listing out these methods. You're building a logical process. What question are we answering? What data do we need? And what method gives us that data? And at what quality do we need that data to be? And of course, that moves on to what we can do to make decisions in each phase of work. The method selection needs to align with the objectives, but also the site setting, and that's really important. And that's what some of the things that Dr. Briggs was talking about with regards to the logic of the MST that we'll go over shortly. We got to understand that the nature of the methods within GSI investigations are complex. They're multidisciplinary, and subject matter experts within those particular disciplines need to be tapped to best achieve your goals and understanding what those methods will give you. And in practice, don't overcommit on those initial phases. Let the initial results tell you where to focus, the more intensive tools, and then that can be integrated into subsequent phases. Sorry, a little delay here. There it goes. So moving on to the method selection. This is where a lot of investigations all go off track. You'll see a common theme here. I'm going to be talking about the MST here a little bit, but also talking about how that works into our process flow. So as Dr. Briggs was mentioning, there's this groundwater surface water tool, the method selection tool box that is available on the USGS website. It's built for structured decision making and basically three steps. And the decision logic is here on the right-hand side. First step, you're selecting your surface water setting and inputting your goals. Then you input your site parameters, and that could be anything from water depth, access constraints, instrumentation, feasibility. And that moves into step three, which was that resulting matrix that Dr. Briggs was showing that shows your method recommendations based off of the goals and those site conditions. And then we work that into on our process on the left within the investigation framework. And this process goes from the scope of work through screening methods to developing a work plan. If you have multiple surface water bodies, let's say a lake and a stream, then you need to address those separately. You need to break them apart. The key principle here is that goals and site setting drive the method selection, and it's not the other way around. So you match the method to the question. You want to validate this definitely with your experts. And then after you've established this, you can iterate the same sort of logic over different phases by starting small, learning from your data, and then expanding to different scales. Next is our example case study, which is really a similar setting to the other case studies that Dr. Jackson and Dr. Briggs presented, but it's very simple, and that's why I chose it. You'll hear some common themes. However, I'll be focusing more on the work plan and investigation process over a time frame, a little bit of a different perspective. So, as a reminder here, in this particular case study, we're in the southeastern U.S. coastal plain. We're in a humid climate, lots of rainfall, 50 inches annual precipitation. We have a highly permeable shallow aquifer system and multiple surface water features, kettle ponds, streams, and wetlands. We'll be focusing on one particular smaller pond to as the example to run through the work plan and investigation practice. The source for the contamination is a AFFF fire training area with a PFAS groundwater plume migrating towards the surface water body. And this surface water body is similar to the surface water body presented before, where it is a flow-through lake. So the groundwater is discharging into the upgrade inside of the pond, and then on the downgrade side, we have discharge back into groundwater. So as the PFAS enters the pond or discharges into the pond, it mixes some retained in sediment. You have transformations that are occurring, and the pond actually becomes a secondary source. And then on the downgrading end, you have impacted pond water discharging into groundwater into a diffuse plume, and then, of course, further migrating towards even more potential receptors. So, what did this investigation actually look like in practice? They used a qualified multidisciplinary team. It consisted of hydrogeologists, engineers, chemists, regulatory specialists, quality managers, and they also had a dedicated project chemist on their staff. They used the DQO process, and they had clearly defined objectives for their work. And they also engaged the stakeholders throughout. They started with a strong baseline CSM. So the regional geologic framework was already well established, and that was from decades of legacy contamination investigations. They also built on that CSM many GSI-specific elements that included lateral and vertical delineation of the groundwater, multi-depth surface water sampling and co-located sediment samples as well. They performed PFAS fingerprinting, which included taking those samples and looking at the compositional PFAS signatures, which they linked the pond back to the source. They also used the data to develop a calibrated groundwater flow model with particle tracking features, and that's really helped them understand with regards to the PFAS migration and the plausibility of impacting downgradient receptors. And they used a phased investigation structure. So they evaluated the data before expanding the scope. They didn't try to characterize everything in one shot. So what worked? Oh, shoot. A little bit of a delay. Sorry about that. There we go. So what worked? They had a well-defined team with clear goals and embedded quality controls in their work plans. The methods aligned with the regulatory drivers and their questions. They used multiple methods that increases defensibility. The phased approach managed the complexity. The PFAS fingerprinting confirmed the source, and that data together fed a calibrated model for supporting ongoing evaluations. What could be improved on the CSM side? While we're dealing with a dynamic system, and those changes over time were not fully quantified, such as seasonality, intense precipitation or storm responses that could have caused gradient reversals, and how that could have modified the flux. The anthropogenic influence weren't fully integrated, such as the stormwater infrastructure that could have been acting as preferential pathways, or the activity in the area of periodic irrigation pumping. And then on the method side, direct flush measurements, let's say using seepage meters, but have quantified the exchange rates rather than just inferring them from the sampling efforts. That would also help enable mass discharge quantification so they could confirm the PFAS presence and actually quantify the mass moving in and out of the system as well. They could have used temperature or tracer-based methods, similar to what Dr. Briggs was talking about with regards to pinpointing where the exchange is concentrated along the shoreline and how that could directly support different remedial options based off of that concentration flux. And the takeaway here is a more deliberate process would have strengthened this characterization and provided a more complete picture of the GSI mass transport. And that's the whole point of what we're talking about here today. Okay, it's not advancing. Just a second. Okay. Key takeaways. What are we walking away with today? Okay. So one, qualified team. Expertise drives quality. You get the right people before you start. Two, use a phased approach. Manage the complexity. You start small, evaluate, and then expand. Three, the methods. Align tools to your setting and objectives. Use resources like the USGS method selection tool. Another plug there. Four, ensure quality. The use of DQOs ensures defensible results. And five, end goals. Every phase should move the project forward using optimal resources. So the bottom line here is success equals expert collaboration plus systematic planning. And that's it. Thank you.
Hey Trey, thank you. Wow, the questions are coming in. So I'll start out with the first question. Can you use a center of mass calculations with a MK to determine if the plume is diffusing or trends show the PFAS compounds increasing or decreasing over time?
Oh, that's a complex question.
Well, they get more complex.
I don't know if I can directly answer that right now, but center of mass obviously is the more generalized averaging of contaminant migration versus the leading edge of your plume and so forth. But I do think that the best answer to that question would be maybe offline, but also the center of mass though is an indication of the bulk mass transfer of the contaminant. So keeping track of that, of course, is really important with regards to how the release is moving within an environment. But the leading edge, of course, is important for receptors because that's the first arrivals as well. So.
Okay. The next one. Are you PFAS fingerprinting by measuring Captain versus anions in groundwater samples? I might have mispronounced that.
I think that the PFAS fingerprinting used a combination of the surface water sampling, the sediment sampling, versus the actual source area as well. Yeah, so they used that in comparison to do that fingerprinting analysis.
All right, this is a three-part question, so I'll read it in parts first. Is PFAS salting out frequently observed in both saltwater and freshwater systems?
Okay, I think that's a maybe a better question for Marty or Andrew. I know they were touching base on salinity systems.
Yeah, I'd say no, but barely enough to be dangerous in that question, being a physical hydrologist, but it can take a stab at it. PFAS salting out, I think, can occur, in terrestrial systems where you have industrial waste or leachate that raises, the salinity of the water, certainly in the, coastal environments. And certain chemicals such as PFOS and PFOA decrease in solubility as there's more salinity, so they can sorb locally. That's one thing we're looking at in the intertidal zone due to tidal pumping, where you kind of have ever-changing concentration of salt in the shallow subsurface within these groundwater discharge zones that are impacted by, various PFAS chemicals. So looking at, some of the ratios of those chemicals that we might expect to sorb locally or be sequestered locally due to salting out compared to the source plume is one technique that, I know the chemists on our team are looking at.
Gotcha. I'll read another. It's actually a four part, but I'll read one other piece to that. Do we see salting out occurring at the GSI with contaminants other than PFAS? Did I break up?
No, I don't have an
Okay.
informed
Okay.
answer there.
Okay.
Yeah,
Okay.
yeah.
No. No
I
problem.
don't know if I can answer that question directly. No.
Okay. Next question is, so when building your CSM, should you focus on short chain or long chain PFAS compounds such as PFOS and PFH excess?
Well, I think from a CSM perspective, you're really looking at all, but obviously the more the shorter chain or the more mobile PFAS, and those are going to be the most important from a transport perspective, especially getting to a surface water body and that migration further down gradient. So those are usually the focus when it comes to the higher end of the transport.
Gotcha. The last question is, this is a little long, so bear with me. For Air Force investigations, where the team of experts in CSM development are typically contracted and based on a statement of work where the contract teams compete to perform the work, SOD development as a third step seems challenging. Do you have thoughts on how the initial process steps you describe would be practically implemented given typical contracting constraints?
That's a really good question. And I think, with stressing about stakeholders, I think stakeholders are also the Air Force. So collaboration with stakeholders is throughout the whole process. So I think, beyond understanding some of the contracts and contract details, just understanding that how the teams work and how it should be structured is, yes, you have a strong core team that's implementing the work. However, they're in strong communication with the stakeholders, which includes the Air Force. Yeah.
Okay. Those are all the questions in the Q&A room. So at this time, I'm gonna turn it over to Kent to kick off o open discussion and general Q&A. And while we're doing that, I don't know if the host is able to pop up the agency slides.
JR, there is a question. Can I have Everett Fortner's email? Also, I thought that mobility had to do also do with grain size. That just came up.
Yes, that is true. Obviously, the hydrogeologic system dictates mobility as well. I was talking more in general of the difference between the central portion of your plume migration versus the leading edge.
Okay, so, right, I'm going to kick it over to Kent for, sorry, I was reading something there. I'm going to kick it over to Kent for our open discussion to Q&A, and then if our host can pop up the agency slides. I didn't know if you had a particular format, Kent. I mean, yeah.
No, I really don't. It's just it's always we tend to stick a any time we can at the end, just because oftentimes we get wrapped up in discussions. But I'm going to take another run at my question from a while back, phrase it a little differently, and what triggered the thought, Trey, was that slide you had with the relatively simple minimalistic CSM on the would have been left side, my left, looking at it anyways, and then you started listing a long list of considerations for GSI CSMs, right? You remember that one?
Yes.
Okay. And so that triggered a thought in my head about Alan Shapiro, who, as many of us know, is a renowned hydrologist who spent a career in characterizing fractured rock hydrology and transport. And he always talked, which is a very complicated system, and particularly if it's a heterogeneous geological system, right? And he always talked about the inability to characterize everything. You know, and he always talked about the need to focus on what were the critical processes and the controlling processes, right? And so in his world, he often came back to diffusion, in and out of dead end pores or dead end fractures and that kind of thing. But I'm trying to jump over now to GSI, so I guess the question might be, in complex systems with all these transport processes, and then on top of that, spatial and temporal heterogeneity, as you spoke to, and Marty did as well, all of three of you actually. In your experience, have you seen patterns? Are there specific critical or controlling processes that are must characterizes? You know, things that must be characterized at a, in a GSI CSM, while other processes might be hypothesized as less critical. That's part one. Second thing, any thoughts on how to go about validating whatever your hypothesis is? So it's open-ended. I know, but it's meant to make us think.
I think from the aspect of the list provided, yes, it does have a lot of items here. Some of them, of course, may not be directly applicable to the goals of your particular study. Obviously, establishing those research questions will help drive the data that's needed and that data gap understanding. From my experience, one of the things that I found to be really important to understand is the hydraulic connection. And the hydraulic connection in relation to the actual flux that's occurring. You can have a hydraulic connection and that's a within a transition zone, but that doesn't necessarily mean what is the actual quantified flux. It could be minimal or it could be actually pretty great. And now, of course, that's going to vary over spatial area. But I think not just using one line of evidence behind that as well is that to understand that needs multiple lines of evidence to have a concrete understanding that that is ex exists. That's kind of my take on it, if anybody else has anything.
Yeah, I can build on that and just say that, the recognition that preferential flow is almost always happening at multiple scales at once, right? From Alan Shapiro's less mobile porosity and fractured rock, it's a preferential flow question. The aggregate in space, just more permeable areas focusing flow that often dominate mass flux, even at, if concentrations there are lower than the places. If we tend to go out and probe around the groundwater surface water interface where there's mucky sediment somewhere and clay sediments and then some sandy sediments, often the strongest vertical hydraulic gradients you're going to measure and highest pore water concentrations are in these fine gradient sediments that aren't exchanging very much water, right? So that actually really matters. So it's like putting the pieces together with the flux rates to get after, like, where do you have enough flux of water combined with some concentration of contaminant? And then, I mean, within those zones, I think you can focus your efforts in terms of diagnosing the flow path characteristic to those areas and what processes are at play that are important. Is it transformation of precursors? Is it less mobile porosity? Because we can't study everything all the time, clearly. But there is some kind of focusing that can be done, I think, if we can efficiently locate zones of preferential groundwater surface water exchange.
So if I'm interpreting, restating, just to make sure I understand and maybe others, you would prioritize characterization of preferential pathways, and in your presentation, you talked a bit about techniques for doing that, and then perhaps once you have some confidence in that, then you might go back and look at the biochemical transformations along those pathways, huh?
I would, and within the sediments of those discharge areas
Yeah.
specifically, as being potentially most influential. You know, one thing that we just don't have a good handle on is like holistic mass fluxes in zones of preferential groundwater discharge. Like we can make a seepage meter measurement, we can make, you know, put in vertical temperature profilers and infer groundwater surface water exchange rates, but those are 1D fluxes. You know, seepage meter covers, you know, less than a square meter. Trying to actually scale up to what is it, you know, 10 square meters? What is that actual defined zone of preferential groundwater discharge that we can apply, you know, some average contaminant concentration to get a holistic mass flux is very difficult. It's not really captured by the methods in our toolbox most of the time, unless you have very strong electrical contrast or temperature contrast that kind of allows you to delineate that area. And I think that's really the kind of the brass ring that a lot of us are going toward is some methodology for better characterizing that holistic mass flux and then the controls behind it, both local at the interface and then on along the source flow paths.
Maybe that's something for us to talk about tomorrow when we start talking about innovations and advances and needs. Yeah.
I'd also just, you know, it may not be as important for human exposure, but if the if your critical organism that you're worried about as a receptor is a sediment organism, the advective flux isn't always the most important. I mean, you can have a, as was already said, a low permeability sediment can have really high concentrations, but very little flux to surface water. But that doesn't mean the organisms that live in the sediment aren't still exposed to it. And so knowing what your receptor is of concern can be important on what your question is. You know, if you're just looking at mass flux to a surface water, yeah, the advective is critical. If you're looking for exposure, the advective flux areas may not be the highest exposure areas.
That kind of feeds back into what Trey was talking about with objectives of the from the get-go, yeah. But what I am hearing is that CSMs built on mass flux are pretty important. Yeah, okay. Which is, I guess, a lesson across all aspects of hydrology that we've, you know, over the last what few decades, and yet we regulate on concentration. Typically. Yeah.
Hey, Kent, there is a question that just came up, and
Sure. Take away.
it's for each of the panelists. What do you see as the next significant advance in GSI investigation slash approaches we're likely to see in the next few years? And what do you see as the next major challenge to address? And that's for each of the panelists.
I'm going to start because I don't have an answer. I don't know. I mean, I think obviously the ability to deal with these giant data sets and multiple types of data and information in a cohesive way is definitely going to be something that's going to get better and better very rapidly, probably. And that'll be critical. But I don't feel comfortable like trying to predict what the next big breakthrough is going to be, you know, in terms of a specific technology.
Yeah, I don't either, but I definitely would chime in on you know, better opportunities to learn from past experiences, being able to tie together what was learned at a GSI investigation in a certain setting and you know, connect that to another area or, you know, across the US or something to that effect. Or even some of the work that's coming out of India where they're taking the method selection to another level using AI, that's something that is pretty novel, but yet, you know, How does that really help us move along? I think it's something that we're still testing out.
Yeah, and I guess I already let my cat out of the bag there, talking about methodology for kind of more holistic mass flux characterization, particularly in preferential groundwater discharge zones, because that's remains very difficult to do. And I think looking forward, just more direct pairing of varied data types and predictive modeling, whether that's kind of machine learning type models, process-based models, some combination of the two, process-guided machine learning. Often we kind of go back to, fairly traditional groundwater flow type modeling and calibrating to aquifer heads and maybe flows at a few locations. We're collecting all these other data types now. There's got to be intelligent ways to kind of incorporate them, either maybe directly in the model calibration process, but or at least the validation process. And certainly, AI ML type models kind of open up the doors there. And I think how to do that in creative ways, make use of just a broad range of data types that we're collecting to characterize the system.
Great, thank you. Yeah, I don't see any more questions in the Q&A, but turn back to Kent.
Yeah, I'll just I'm going to turn it right back to you, but I just wanted to say thank you again to our three speakers. Very much appreciate the discussion as much as the presentations, and that's always been a hallmark of FRTR meetings, is that we try and emphasize as much back and forth and discussion as we do any direct formal presentation. So thank you.
We have one more hot topic question. Do we want to take it?
Sure.
From the perspective of protecting receptors, the mass discharge from the bulk of contamination would seem to be a focus of the GSI investigations. While mass discharge from low permeability zones may affect site closure, but not represent the higher mass discharge, what are your thoughts in terms of priorities for funding? Anybody want to take that?
I think Andrew, spoke to that to some degree of thinking about what are the receptors of most concern? Are they local organisms? Is it water supply, downstream, concentrations where kind of holistic mass fluxes are more important, or local concentrations more important? I've got just less knowledge on the regulatory side of things to answer that though.
Kind of reminds me of the discussion we had as a profession. When was it? Back when the National Research Council stood up a blue ribbon panel to look at progress on complex sites, right? When was that? 20 years ago. And how to go about prioritizing. It's been an ongoing discussion we've had ever since then, and I don't think we as a profession have fast answer for that, except that maybe we prioritize sites that where the where there's a, for lack of a better phrase, clear and present danger to receptors, right? And worried less about ultimate site closure. But maybe that's just me talking.
So, JR, before you proceed with closure, I just want to reiterate, thanks to Marty, we now have the toolbox software link and the supporting MST paper link. Both of those links are down in the chat.
Awesome. Awesome. Did my slide come up?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So, again, thank you, Kent, Ray, Shelley, especially our presenters, and especially those of you that are online from all over the world. Thank you for attending day one of the FRTR Spring 2026 meeting. I just want to wrap a couple of things up. If everyone can continue to monitor the Q&A to make sure nothing pops up as I'm closing out. Again, you came here either because you're on the Kluwen website or maybe your coworkers dragged you into a conference room to watch this meeting. Regardless, there's a lot of other events, technology transfer, training available on the Kluwin platform. So we encourage you to explore and navigate Kluwin. Also, every month there's a Tech Direct. I gave you the link there, or you can Google EPA Tech Direct and you can get the latest issue. That's a monthly publication that tells you about the various training the EPA has to you. And then going on to the next slide. So tomorrow, oh, so just again, if you want to reach out to the presenters, their information's here. You clicked on their, click under presenter moderators, and you can see the information, their email at the university or at the federal agency they work at. And then this is just a snapshot of the agenda. Once again, you can find all this information on the Kluwin under FRTR Spring 2026. But you can see the speakers we have lined up for day two and the flow, which would be very similar to today. And let's see. Well, again, feedback is always welcome, and everything that's presented today is available again on the Kluwin website. I'm going to see if Kent had any final words. If
No,
not,
I
I'm gonna.
really don't. Just take us home, and see you tomorrow.
Okay, I
Thank you,
appreciate
everybody.
it. All right, well, you all have a great rest of the day, and I will hopefully see all of you tomorrow.